This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Business is booming in the last bastion of communism. My guest Orville Schell has written a new book called Mandate of Heaven about the new generation of entrepreneurs, dissidents, bohemians, and technocrats who are shaping China's future. Schell has written several other books about China's politics and culture, including Discos and Democracy and To Get Rich is Glorious. He says you can learn a lot about what's happening in China now by looking at its pop culture.
You know, in a country like China, where political dissent is not possible without being arrested, or at least having dire consequences, people are forced to turn to other ways to express their dissatisfaction, their disappointment, their rebelliousness. And one of the ways they do it in China is obliquely through pop culture. And pop culture is much freer than official party-sponsored culture, because in many ways it's hooked right up to the market. So rock and roll, for one, is an area which really stands outside of all the officially sanctioned and officially subsidized and run institutions that used to comprise the total corpus of institutions in China. And it's very interesting to look at what these pop music singers are doing and saying and singing and how they're acting, because it suggests, I think, what's to come. I mean, pop culture is often a harbinger of politics of the future. And since we don't really have a tremendous amount of overt political expression, except in a few very diehard dissidents, this is where we have to look to see what the spirit of the times is saying.
You have a whole chapter about Chairman Mao as pop art. How is his image being used now as a pop culture fad?
Well, it's a very confusing situation. It started out a number of years ago when people began hanging little icons of Chairman Mao, little pictures of him laminated in plastic from their rearview mirrors of cars and buses and trucks. And then gradually these little icons, they got tassels and bells and gewgaws, and they got more and more sort of elaborate and fancy. And people did it because, well, they sort of liked the old guy, as he's referred to in Chinese, you know, talao renjia, as they say, the old fellow. But also because I think Mao, in a curious way, had been, it was a way to pull him down off a pedestal, make him real. They were also at the same time, paradoxically, turning him into a kind of a St. Christopher medal, something that would protect them. And taxi drivers would tell you, well, if they had Mao hanging there, they wouldn't have accidents, or they wouldn't get into trouble. So it was a funny way of taking Mao, hauling him down off this pedestal, making him sort of real, and also playing with him a little. And then artists began to get into the act, and not only did you get a lot of kitsch memorabilia, I went up to the Gate of Heavenly Peace in front of Tiananmen Square a few months ago, and there, where Mao used to stand to review the troops and review his people during these national days, there was just one long counter after another of sort of kitsch Mao pop stuff for sale. There were watches with holograms of Mao's face on the crystal. There were cigarette lighters with his face in vinyl on the side that beeped out electronic versions of "The East is Red." There were pocket watches where, you know, his little hands going around telling the time. And it was very strange. And you wonder what is happening. Well, what's happening is that Mao is being thrown into the marketplace. He's being consumed, and he's also being mortalized, and he's also being played with, and he's being turned into something that's less than the awe-inspiring great leader which he once was, and who people feared and people obeyed. The government can't crack down, because you seem to be extolling the patron saint of the Communist Party, but really you're kind of thumbing your nose at him.
But isn't Mao out now within the Communist Party as a symbol?
Not really. They don't know what to do with Mao. I mean, there he is, stuffed, you know, in his mausoleum out in front of the Gate of Heavenly Peace, right in Tiananmen Square. I mean, he is still the sort of textual source for Communist Party doctrine, and they need to keep this doctrine, because without it, how can they justify ruling alone? ruling unilaterally. Why shouldn't they have other parties competing with them? Well, they say they represent the interests of the proletariat, and Mao's doctrine is the canon that backs this up. So to get rid of Mao would be to completely undermine the justification for the party ruling alone. So they've got to keep him, even as they sort of they try to retreat a little bit, and even as he's being devoured by these sort of campy, kitschy industries that are making fortunes selling his visage in all over the country.
My guest is Orville Schell. His new book about China is called Mandate of Heaven. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Orville Schell. Earlier this year, there was a branch of the Hard Rock Cafe that opened in China. Who got it in there?
Well, you know, you can do almost anything in China today that isn't overtly political as long as it's business. And the Hard Rock Cafe is good business because Chinese are very enamored, as people are all over the world, of American pop icons and American pop institutions.
But isn't the government afraid of those icons? I mean, the real pop icons, Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, the Beatles, you mentioned that there's pictures of all of them in this branch of the Hard Rock Cafe. They stand for a certain defiance against authority, a rebellion.
Well, I think the party has decided, and they did this shortly after 1989, that, you know, you couldn't crack down everywhere at once. You can crack down politically, but you've got to allow some escape hatches. And so two of the ones which seem to have been permitted are, one, you can make money now. You can do just about anything you want to make money. And the second is pop culture. So these are kind of wonderful distractions that keep people away from politics, and they're also very much related to the marketplace. They're diversions.
What's happening musically in China now, in pop and rock?
It's a pretty interesting scene. Originally, it was a rather deadly situation, where most people were just imitating sort of Canto, Hong Kong rock, or Taiwan rock singers. But now there's getting to be a number of people who are really quite creative, and they're really off on their own and discovering a kind of a new synthesis between Western and Eastern forms of music. One of them I write about in my book, Cui Jian, who's perhaps the best known. And he was originally a classical trumpet player from the Beijing Philharmonic. And in the mid-80s, he did what very few people dared to do. He left his official job. He gave up all of the perks that come with it. And he went out into this sort of margin that was beginning to grow up on the side of official society. He supported himself by playing in hotels for foreigners and nightclubs and by making tapes and records and selling them to kids. And he got quite a reputation. And he was very emblematic of this whole movement of people who, culturally speaking, are dropping out. And they're finding places on these sort of the littoral, the margins of official society, and they're hooking themselves up to the market, and they're doing quite nicely.
I guess the government is learning that you can't have economic reform without letting in cultural changes, too.
Well, I think this is their strategy, but in the short run, it seems to have been successful because it has distracted people from politics. It's given them something to dream about, to hope about, and to exercise their hopes and ambitions. In the long run, though, I think it's much more subversive. But I don't think the Chinese Communist Party now really has much interest in the long run. After 1989, they needed a quick fix. And the quick fix was to save themselves with capitalism, to start producing. And as Deng said after his historic trip down to near the special economic zone near Hong Kong, you know, it doesn't matter whether you call it capitalist or communist. What matters is, does it produce? So this is the new hallmark of success. And if it produces, it's good. And that's what people are that's what their guiding light these days.
So do you think the government is hoping that prosperity will give the middle class a reason not to rock the boat?
Well, I think it already has. China is developing a middle class. And I think in certain very fundamental ways, the middle class is the most conservative class in China. Now, this runs counter to the argument that the market ultimately will open up Chinese society and create a civil society, alternative institutions, and things of this nature. But my own reading is that in a curious way, even as life becomes more relaxed in China, it has a funny way of not only conservatizing the nouveau riche, but also of sucking the air out of the room so that legitimate culture and politics have nothing to breathe. Because the bitter fact is that, you know, serious culture and politics don't make money. So the market has a way of marginalizing people who engage in these serious pursuits. One writer told me, I said, listen, how can you publish this experimental literature? I mean, why does the government allow you to do it? He said, they allow me to do it because nobody reads it. So he was just allowed to sort of peck away on the border, and no one paid attention to him, and so he wasn't a threat, because what the market wants is karaoke bars and discotheques and restaurants and sports matches, not serious fiction or serious art or opera or any of these kinds of things, which have really been suffocated by the market boom.
So are there parts of pop culture now that are doing well but that the government also sees as subversive?
Well, I think rock music is one that they really don't quite know what to do with. This rock musician Cui Jian, they usually don't allow him to perform in large venues unless he's willing to give benefits. And the benefits are for the youth league program to send kids to school. But even sometimes then they cancel them because people get so rowdy, they get so cranked up. I saw one concert in Nanjing, and it was just amazing. You know, there were 30, 40,000 kids in a sports arena, and there were probably 4,000 military police in there trying to keep control. But you could see he was touching their heart. Even with his very oblique and cryptic lyrics, there was something about his rebellious spirit and the energy of his music that reached into the hearts of these kids who had no other way to express their frustrations. The police were very, very nervous. And I write about this in my book, there's one section of the audience which was reserved for officials who had to come because it was a benefit. I mean, it looked as if somebody had administered a tranquilizer to them. They were sitting there sort of stony-faced and perplexed and watching this powerful energy, this synergy between this musician and the audience. And I thought at the time, I felt I hadn't seen this sort of energy since I'd left Tiananmen Square in 1989.
I know you just read the new book about China by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudan. And they say in their book that they think that China is very confusing right now because it marks the intersection of the two most important trends of the late 20th century, the collapse of communism and the rise of East Asia as an independent powerhouse. Do you agree with that perception?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt about it that East Asia is the powerhouse of the future. And China, even more so than Japan, I think, will figure very large in this future. And the question is, can China slowly evolve to play a Pacific role in this future, or is it going to dissemble somehow? And if it does, it's going to be the most profound consequence, not only to Asia, but to the world. Not only are there questions like the environment, but just imagine, I mean, if China starts spinning off refugees like Cuba or Haiti, which it already has done to some degree, I mean, it could have just the profoundest consequences for other nations. Just a few, maybe one-tenth or a fifth or 5% of the Chinese population, if they decide to break loose, that's, it's 100 million people. And 50 million people. What are you going to do with that? Well, so it's very important that somehow China be able to keep its balance. And how we might best help that happen is a question which American policymakers wrestle with at the same time. They try to figure out how are they going to express their concern over such questions as human rights and nuclear proliferation and arms sales and things of this nature. We really haven't decided how to fit these things together into a coherent policy.
Well, Orville Schell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure, Terry.
Orville Schell's new book about China is called Mandate of Heaven. This is Fresh Air.